I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The guessing game has begun as to who will replace Tom Ridge, who resigned yesterday as head of Homeland Security, and what direction the agency needs to go in. We're joined from Washington by former Virginia Governor James Gilmore. He served as chair of the Gilmore Commission, that's the Congressional Advisory Panel to Assess Domestic Response Capabilities for Terrorism Involving Weapons of Mass Destruction. It was formed in 1999, of course, before the events of 9/11. Governor, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Robin. That's kind of a long name for a commission, isn't it?
It certainly is, but it's a commission that really resonates now because, as you know, your commission in 2000 recommended an office much like the one Tom Ridge held, but you wanted it to have real authority to deal with issues of terrorism, to coordinate work with other offices, to have budgetary authority, a role superior to cabinet offices, direct lines to the president. Were you disappointed in the office ultimately formed for Tom Ridge?
Yes. At the beginning, I think they set out in the correct direction by putting Ridge into the White House with a direct line of communication to the president. But they didn't give that office the power that we had recommended, budgetary authority, for example, over other parts of government, any sort of sense that that person was over the other areas that involved Homeland Security. And so when that office didn't succeed, they went to the department strategy and set up a department and threw 22 agencies together so that they could have a structure to deal with Homeland Security. That created some positives, but of course it also created a managerial challenge.
Well, let's ask you about that because, Tom Ridge, it's acknowledged he had one of the toughest jobs in Washington, but he was also poked fun at because of things like the color-coded alert and his suggestion that Americans buy duct tape and plastic. Were those silly? Will they go?
Well, he was trying to respond to some pressure that he was hearing, that, gee, you know, you're telling us that we're in danger, but you're not telling us what to do. And it's hard, frankly, to communicate what to do. I think the better approach is to explain to the American people that an attack could occur, that we've always had catastrophes we had to deal with, that we do that. We're going to work very hard to make the country secure, but we really are not going to lose the republic over this unless we got into a real serious bio attack or something like that. And even then, I think that the republic would survive. So we have to just put things into proper proportion and explain the proper role that that this has in the life of the nation.
Well, as you know, Governor, one of the biggest questions is how to pay for it. And in your opinion, should private companies, let's say the oil industry, chemical, nuclear industry, should they be forced to pick up the tab for providing security? There's a big debate now as to whether it should be tax dollars or private dollars. And some Americans say they should be required to carry the cost.
Well, you might find some mix in that, but my belief is the critical infrastructure owners, chemical industries and so on, want to do the right thing. And frankly, they have an obligation to their shareholders to do the right thing. They have risk of exposure to liability from the law community if they don't do the right things. The trick is to tell them what to do. They don't want to waste money. They have an obligation to their shareholders not to waste money. So what they really need is direction. And that might mean that working together with the entire community, you put together some regulations that set some standards so that people can spend their money correctly. And that's what I mean by a sharpened-up national strategy.
You also were quoted as saying way back that local responders are the ones who are the most important when it comes to these kinds of attacks, and they should be integrated fully with the federal and the state governments. Have they been?
Well, I was governor of Virginia when the Pentagon was attacked, which is in Virginia, and I watched the local responders, the fire, police, and rescue, and doctors at work in that particular catastrophe, and that still has to be done more. I've been in touch with the local responders, and they feel that they still don't completely understand their role in the national strategy, and I think that has to be fully developed, and more communications need to be done.
Yeah. Well, sir, in your private life, you've been serving as an advisor on security advisory boards for companies like Lucent. Your name has been mentioned as a candidate to replace Tom Ridge. Would you take the job, and what's the first thing you'd do?
Well, I never comment on any procedure that the president would go through in order to pick his government. But maybe most importantly, good, solid communication with the American people, and above all things, making sure that anything we put into place is consistent with our civil freedoms of this country. If we give up our civil freedoms and turn ourselves into a surveillance society, out of fear, then at that point, the enemy really will have gone a long way to undoing the republic, and we cannot permit that to happen.
Have we? Do you fear we're on a slippery slope?
Not yet, but I think that the advent of this major technology that we see could be a danger. We now can watch everybody all the time. We can listen to everybody all the time. We can record data on people all the time. And, you know, at some point you have to ask yourself, just because you can do it, is it the right thing for the country? And I believe we have to remember the great historical roots of this nation and the fundamental principles that keep us a free people, freer than anybody else in the world and a beacon to the rest of the world.
Former Virginia Governor James Gilmore, he also served as chair of the Gilmore Commission. Governor, thank you so much for talking to us.
Good. Thank you very much, and we'll all work together to make the country a more secure place.
Massachusetts school district has sparked an outcry from parents after cutting the time for recess at elementary schools in half. Students now have 10 minutes for recess and 20 minutes to eat their lunch. It's part of a nationwide trend to take play time out of school time. And joining us to find out why, we have Kathleen Kennedy Manzo on the line. She's an associate editor at Education Week magazine. We also have Nadine Binkley. She's the superintendent of schools in Peabody, Massachusetts. And Nadine, I want to start with you because it was your school district's decision to cut recess from 20 to 10 minutes. Why?
Well, Robin, this was part of a larger plan. I've been in the Peabody school system for approximately a year, and when I was brought into the system, the mandate from the school committee was to address issues of student achievement and dropout rates. We measure student achievement by many different ways, but one is our state testing, which is called the MCAS testing. Another thing we look at is SAT scores, and, of course, we look at report cards and classroom assessments. Let me tell you a little bit about Peabody, Massachusetts. We're a school district of about 6,700 students. We have 8 elementary schools, a middle school, and a high school. And our student achievement measured by our state testing is at maybe slightly below, slightly above in different areas, the state testing.
So what was your thinking, that by getting 10 minutes back from recess time, you could address some of those testing concerns?
Let me tell you what we had in place around lunchtime previous to this. We had an hour in which the students spent 20 minutes at lunch, 20 minutes at recess, and 20 minutes doing silent reading. Silent reading got cut, and we thought we could make lunch recess into a half an hour and then come back and do instruction.
Well, Nadine, we're going to talk about this in depth, but as you know, we have parents listening right now who are saying, you are kidding me. Half an hour, my kid, especially in the early grades, can't even get their galoshes on and off in that amount of time. 10 minutes to go outside and play or just to get some kind of movement, just it's not enough time.
First of all, our students generally get dressed in the classroom, and that's not counted as part of their recess time. With our young students, our first graders may need a slightly longer recess. They may even need a little more lunch time. We're pretty flexible around that, but we're hoping that once we get to third, fourth, and fifth grade, that we can pretty much keep to a 20-minute lunch, 10-minute recess.
Nadine, stay right there. I want to bring back in Kathleen Manzo from Education Week magazine. Kathleen, we know that some people are saying, wow, they only had 20 minutes and they cut it to 10. As you know, nationwide, some schools have none.
Yes, I believe there are a number of schools who don't have recess at all. And that may be a recent phenomenon. Over the last decade, as states began implementing more rigorous content standards and accountability systems to measure how students are doing, there's been enormous pressure on the school day to find room for more instruction. And as schools began devoting more time and resources to core subjects, others that aren't considered critical have suffered, and recess having little pure academic value is naturally a target for cuts.
Yeah, I'm looking at a CDC, Centers for Disease Control report that says that Atlanta and Orlando have eliminated recess altogether. One of the concerns was safety. The children may not be safe at recess. Nadine, as a superintendent, in addition to the testing, what other pressures are you feeling?
Certainly the bullying issue is one that we feel, and increased lawsuits. But this was primarily done to give students more time with teachers. We have a very, very short day our students are in school for 5 hours, 55 minutes. That's all controlled by teachers' contract and teachers' negotiations. And as you know, it's very difficult to get teachers through negotiations to extend the school day. So when you want to look at time on task, you end up looking within the confined period of time that you have rather than extending the day. So we were able to pick up 2.5 hours of instruction time during the week by eliminating the silent reading after recess and the 10 minutes of recess.
Hey, but at what cost? Because, again, I'm looking at this CDC report, and it also says that recess is a time where students have one of their few opportunities to interact, to develop social skills. Kathleen, tell us more about what educators find can happen that's positive in recess.
Well, school is a very social experience, especially for kids in the earlier grades. They get to talk to friends. They really have little time to do that given the increased academic content throughout class time. And, you know, they learned critical skills about interacting and developing relationships. Also, the physical activity that many students engage in during recess, you know, is essential for them to, you know, have the energy they need to learn and burn off their excess energy and, you know, to maintain their health as well.
Nadine Binkley, again, superintendent of schools in Peabody, Massachusetts. Studies also show that, as Kathleen said, kids are like adults in that way. The longer they sit without a recess break, the less attentive they are.
Yes, and I agree. We give our students a break in the morning where they're in the class, but they have the opportunity to move around, to have a snack. Also, our classes, elementary classrooms, are very different from even the way they were 5 or 10 years ago. Most of our teachers utilize a centers approach where students are working with other students in small groups, doing projects, learning problem-solving skills, developing their social skills. They go out for, during the week, they go out for physical education class. They go out for music class, a lot of which is movement.
Well, Nadine Beakley, we're going to be talking in a moment with a parent who took on her school district and won. In fact, she took on her entire state and won when it came to the issue of recess. You've just started this, or you just announced this in Peabody. What are parents saying to you?
Well, it's mixed. There are certainly some very, very vocal parents who are saying that our children need more time to play. And I understand that. Our children are out of school at 2:40, and there's still several hours in the day where students can get together with other children and play. My view is that we have our very talented teachers for only a short period of time, and we need to take as much advantage of them as we can.
Nadine Binkley, superintendent of schools in Peabody, Massachusetts. Thank you, Nadine. We'll let you get back to work. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Kathleen Kennedy Manzo of Education Week magazine. And we'll be joined by a parent who sparked a movement to bring recess back to schools in one state, and she won. And later, Bombay, the biggest city in the world, and soon it's going to have more residents than all of Australia. We'll find out why Bombay is the future of the planet. Stay right there. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about recess in schools. It's sometimes called the fourth R in education, but nowadays the focus on the other Rs, reading, writing, arithmetic, testing, it's not an R, but it's there. Well, it's pushing aside the long-cherished tradition of just playing. We just heard from a school superintendent here in Massachusetts who's cut school recess from 20 to 10 minutes. And we've also been talking to Kathleen Kennedy Manzo of Education Week magazine. And Kathleen, we're going to speak to a parent in a moment, but do you understand and are you hearing nationwide the pressures that Superintendent Binkley was describing that led her to cut back on recess?
Absolutely. In the last couple of years, the state standards movement has evolved, but also the federal No Child Left Behind Act has kicked in, putting even greater pressure on the school day because schools are measured on their progress in raising achievement in math and reading and, in a couple of years, science. So administrators face quite a conundrum. On the one hand, they feel they have to carve out more instructional time for key subjects, especially for struggling students, to bring them up to the level that they require. But they must do it without adding additional time to the school day or the school year. And there's also competing pressures from parents who, for the most part, want higher standards and more academics, but they want balance, reminding educators that these are children.
Well, and one of those parents is on the line. Rebecca Lamphere started a grassroots movement in Virginia to bring recess back. She won. Rebecca, hi.
Good afternoon.
And can you first of all tell us what happened in Virginia? What was going on and what inspired you to launch this effort?
I bought a house next to an elementary school, and after living there about a year, I realized I never saw the children on the playground. So I did some research and discovered that in the city I was living in, Virginia Beach, Virginia, out of 55 elementary schools, only three had true recess. The children were out and allowed to have free play on the playground. So that shocked me, and I started a grassroots movement, did some research, started a petition, held rallies, and ended up getting the Virginia Beach School Board to reverse their opinion on recess and actually develop a resolution in favor of recess. And I continued with the movement. It spread to neighboring cities and spread to the state level, where the state school board mandated daily recess statewide.
On what basis? I mean, why was recess so important to you?
I just had this strong instinct that it was very important to me as a child, and so I needed to look into it and find out why it was so important, why I was so upset at it being taken away. And through my research, I found that recess and physical activity fosters learning. It made me more aware. It's a natural mood elevator, and it gets more oxygen to the brain, which makes children more apt and receptive to learning.
In addition to the emotional issues, and Kathleen, the emotion issues are very strong, but the science is also there, but so is the pressure. I mean, where do you see this going?
Well, you know, recess is just the beginning, because they're trying to fit more academics into the school day, as I said before, and especially in those subjects that are tested and on which they will be measured. So administrators and officials all over the country are trying to find ways to whittle minutes here and there, and they're targeting a number of areas not seen as critical, including subjects like physical education, music and art, and even critical subjects like social studies and foreign language are feeling the squeeze. And also things like school assemblies and class trips, even more than recess, have been cut back considerably or completely eliminated in many places. And even other things held sacred for, you know, generations, such as nap time in kindergarten and pre-K, are being reconsidered as they try to push more, you know, early reading and early math instruction into those grades.
Well, Rebecca, and by the way, do you have children?
I do. I have a 10-year-old daughter.
Right. So you obviously have seen the effect of recess on your daughter.
Absolutely.
What do you suggest that teachers and schools do to find this time to do what they are mandated to do, which is raise test scores?
Well, I understand the push for accountability, and that they want the children to learn more material. More time spent on a subject does not necessarily equal more learning. We need to keep in mind that the children have needs that go beyond testing. They have physical, social, and emotional needs. If you have 5 hours and you give an hour break, 4 hours of learning will be the same as 5 hours spent on that subject, because the children have gotten the break that they needed. So you have faster learning by giving that break. Mm.
And Kathleen Kennedy Manzo of Education Week magazine, I have tremendous respect for teachers, and I say that flat out, and for administrators with these competing pressures that they have. But we're wondering, too, is there any study that shows that this cutback on free time for kids sort of reflects the general cutback in free time for adults as well, that it's somehow being transferred to students?
I think that's right on observation. You know, the entire country is feeling more pressure to increase productivity and help the economy, and that's a message that definitely trickles down to the schools, where There's pressure from the business community to prepare students more for the world of work.
We could all use more hopscotch. Adults and kids. And Rebecca, I'm just as we let you go, we know you've recently moved to Las Vegas, where adults go to play, but have you noticed a drop in recess there as well?
Actually, I was sent an article that came out in March that shows that the Las Vegas area has eliminated or is eliminating recess. There's definitely an issue in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Boy, and they have no idea who just moved into town. Rebecca Lamphier, who started a grassroots movement in Virginia to bring recess back to schools and was very successful. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also, we've been talking to Kathleen Kennedy Manzo of Education Week magazine. Kathleen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow we'll have a look at the future of the United Nations. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Bombay, also called Mumbai, is a city of 19 million people on the western coast of India. It's the home of Bollywood film stars, gang lords, and thousands of ordinary Indians. The courts in India have a backlog of cases that will take 350 years to clear. And just breathing in Bombay is equivalent to smoking 2.5 packs of cigarettes a day. But Bombay is also intoxicating. Writer Suketu Mehta was Bombay-born, then lived abroad for 21 years before moving back. The result is his new memoir, Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. And Suketu Mehta joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
You write, Bombay, yes, the biggest city on the planet of a race of city dwellers. The future of urban civilization on that planet, God help us. Briefly, what do you mean by that?
Well, I wanted to look at Bombay not just because it's the city I grew up in, but because it's emblematic of a group of mega cities, that is, cities with 10 million people or more, such as Sao Paulo or Rio or Lagos or Jakarta. And this is the future of humanity. The UN just came out with a report that says that by the year 2030, 60% of humans will be living in cities. And not in cities like New York and London so much, but in these vast, sprawling megacities, which are characterized by uncontrolled migration from the countryside and kind of chaotic civic services. So Bombay really represents the future of urban civilization. It's the biggest city. And I say, God help us, because anyone who's been to Bombay knows that it's not a very happy prospect.
Well, hardly any toilets, but every poor person has a television.
That's right. You know, the notion of what's a luxury and what's a necessity really has been upended. So while 60% of the population of Bombay lives in slums, these are middle-class people. They're not beggars, you know, they're not destitute. They work in offices, and they have a whole array of electronics within these slums. It's just that housing, private toilets, These things are a luxury. Good roads, safe drinking water, that's a luxury.
Yeah.
But televisions or computers, they're omnipresent in the slums.
As you said, you were born in Calcutta, moved to Bombay, came to New York in your teens, where you described yourself as somebody who was a citizen of a country called longing. Do I have that right?
That's right. When I came to New York, I missed Bombay like an organ of my body. And my father said in exasperation, when you were there, you wanted to come here. Now that you're here, you want to go there. And it's at that time that I realized I had a new nationality, citizen of the country of longing. Mm. I've always had this hankering to go back and to see if I could go home again. And that really is the quest that motivated my book.
Well, what did you find?
Well, I found home in strange ways, Robin. It wasn't the home that I'd left behind. I found home through the stories of the city, of its gangsters and bar girls and movie stars. And it was a strange sort of home. But at the end, I found that not only can you go home again, you can also leave again. And I've also realized that for people like us, rootless cosmopolites, we might be called, home isn't a geographically intact entity. I have one room of my home in Brooklyn, another in Bombay, another in London or Paris. And I can move between the different rooms of my home as if they were really in one building.
Mm. Well, and you, as you said, you moved between these different and very disparate populations in Bombay when you were there freely. And it's amazing. In one scene, you're sitting in a suburban hotel room with some gangsters and talking philosophy while they play with their guns. Later, one of the chiefs offers you a free hit.
Right.
Did you ever feel like you were over your head?
Absolutely. I thought I'd go mad. Because in the same day, you know, I'd begin my day in the slums of Madanpura, you know, and see street children. It just broke my heart. And then end the day by going to a select party of billionaires. And in the middle, I'd roam around the movie sets and go see my friends, the bar dancers. So Bombay has that kind of extremes, which really, as a writer, I mean, it fascinated me. But sometimes it really got too much for me. And I just had to retreat into my room and write it out.
Well, you know, there's also a stereotyped image of Bombay in the U.S. as an overheated city with tons of, you know, humanity living on top of each other and no toilets. And your observations, in some, you know, way, support that. How do you feel about promoting a stereotype?
Well, all of this is true. They're, you know, the first and the third worlds live right next to each other in Bombay. And parts of inner Bombay have a population density of 1 million people per square mile. There's no getting around it. But you begin from the stereotypes and then go deeper, which is what I've tried to do in my book. I've tried to look at these 1 million people and then go and get their stories.
You write that soon there will be more people living in Bombay than on the entire continent of Australia.
Two things. The most amazing thing about Bombay is that it still continues to take in people. It allows people to come in and gives them a little patch of the pavement to sleep on. So it's a tremendously hospitable city with a very large heart. But it's not a good thing that Bombay will have more people than the continent of Australia. This is happening directly because of the agricultural subsidies in the developed world that the rich countries give to their farmers. This results in an impoverishment of the countryside. Mm. When people cannot make a living farming, they will take the first train to cities like Bombay.
So that's an issue that needs to be addressed. In the meantime, you mentioned both trains and Bombay's big heart. Would you do me a favor and read a passage from your book and set it up for us? This is when you're about to get on a train and you're explaining. That experience seems to sort of sum up what Bombay itself is like.
Absolutely, Robin. This is, you know, I saw a lot of sadness in Bombay. I saw a lot of killing. But then I also saw this. And this, to me, really represents the heart of the city. If you are late for work in the morning in Bombay and you reach the station just as the train is leaving the platform, you can run up to the packed compartments and find many hands stretching out to grab you on board, unfolding outward from the train like petals. As you run alongside the train, you will be picked up and some tiny space will be made for your feet on the edge of the open doorway. Consider what has happened. Your fellow passengers, already packed tighter than cattle are legally allowed to be, having stood like this for hours, retain an empathy for you, know that your boss might yell at you or cut your pay if you miss this train, and will make space where none exists to take one more person with them. And at the moment of contact, they do not know if the hand that is reaching for theirs belongs to a Hindu or Muslim or Christian or Brahmin or untouchable. All they know is that you're trying to get to the city of gold, and that's enough. Come on board, they say. We'll adjust.
Suketu Mehta reading from his new book, Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. Suketu, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Still to come, from Gypsy Rose Lee to The Sopranos' Bada Bing, a study of striptease through the ages. You're listening to Here and Now. Election officials in Ohio are still counting votes, and a rare second vote may have to be held in North Carolina. Yesterday on Here and Now, we heard that most analysts conclude that while there are many irregularities in election 2004, there's no evidence of fraud. Well, what about the 4,000 votes that vanished without a trace in a computer in North Carolina, or the county in Indiana that gave several hundred Democratic votes to Libertarians? Joining us now, Boston Globe reporter Brian Mooney. In today's paper, he's tallied voting errors nationwide. And Brian, your conclusion, just mistakes or fraud, and either way, when they're all fixed and adjusted, would the election be altered?
There are always errors and mistakes in elections. There always have been. There always will be. There is no foolproof technology. But there were some serious errors, and a lot of them were mechanical, machine-related. Most of them were caught in time that they could be corrected in time for the final tallies. But, you know, as the doubters will say, you know, those are the ones they've discovered. You know, how many did they not find? Mm. And we'll never know. But I don't think there's evidence of fraud. And, you know, for the conspiracy theorists who think that, you know, this election and the last one were stolen, it would require an enormous conspiracy involving many people in and out of government.
And in both parties.
It's difficult to imagine.
Well, but there are still so many questions. For instance, did you find out why were the early exit polls so different from the outcome of this race?
Oversampled women. The number of people who vote early in the day tend to be disproportionately leaned towards women, and it skewed the results. I mean, that's the conclusion that everyone's sort of reached.
You write that there were 42 reports of total breakdowns of machines in New Orleans, 28 in Philadelphia, 15 reports of catastrophic machine failure in Mercy County, Pennsylvania. What are we to know of that?
Well, it happens. And in these cases, what happened, you know, they had backup paper ballots they gave to people. And there were questions about whether or not they were kept securely during the day in some of these places. You know, people were discouraged and went home because the lines got long. That's a problem. It was a problem in a lot of states. And it's a problem that I think will have to be addressed.
What about that county in Ohio where President Bush got 3,893 more votes than there are actually voters? I think there are 638 voters.
Right. That was discovered. And, you know, what happens is election officials at the local level, they check the number of people who checked in at the polls against the tallies that the machines or they manually count to find out if there are discrepancies before they tally the vote, and that was obviously a case where there was a big discrepancy. The error on the voting machine, which I think is an older model voting machine, has not been explained. They still haven't figured out what caused it.
And again, we're thinking of all the private investigators, if you will. I'm holding a study by a group of doctoral students at UC Berkeley.
Yeah.
It's been flying around on email, and they say that the association between electronic voting and increased support for President Bush in areas when there was an electronic voting, he did not have that support, is impossible to overlook.
It doesn't hold up. I mean, you know, they claim that, you know, Bush may have gotten 72,000 excess votes in Broward County, which is the area around Fort Lauderdale, the most Democratic county in the state in terms of total number of votes. If he had received 72,000 excess votes, that would have meant that he actually got fewer votes this year than he did in 2000 in that county. And there were 132,000 additional voters this time. I mean, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
And what about Ohio? Why are they still counting there? And could there be a surprise? President Bush won the state by 136,483 votes, but 155,000 provisional ballots haven't been counted yet.
Well, they have been counted. They just haven't been recorded at the Secretary of State's office. I think today is the deadline for the 88 counties to certify their final results, which will include the provisional ballots, the overseas absentee ballots, and a number of those provisional ballots, which are basically ballots cast by people whose it wasn't clear at the time they voted that they were actually registered to vote where they showed up. I think about 80% of them were counted, so the number that will be in the final tally will be considerably less than 155,000. So if Kerry got them all, I still don't think he'd carry the state.
So, Brian, other papers have also done analysis. I'm thinking of the Miami Herald, Slate.com, seem to have come to the same conclusion as you. What do you think we have here? A mess as opposed to a stolen election?
Yeah, I mean, it's a moderate mess. It's not a huge mess. There are always problems in elections. There always have been. There is no foolproof technology, and there's human error where, you know, humans are involved. And if the race wasn't close, no one would have noticed. But, you know, there are problems that need to be fixed, the issues of technology and creating technologies that, you know, the public can have faith in that will have, you know, an auditable permanent record to check when things are all said and done and they need recounts or whatever. I mean, those things need to be addressed.
Brian Mooney, staff writer for the Boston Globe. Brian, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Striptease has been criticized, glorified, but until now it hasn't really been studied, given a serious scholarly look. Well, Oxford University Press has just published the book, Striptease, The Untold History of the Girly Show, and it takes the reader from stripping's vaudeville roots to its decline in the sexually liberated 60s. The book is written by Rachel Stier, head of the Dramaturgy and Dramatic Criticism Program at the Theater School of DePaul University. Recently, Rachel spoke with Here and Now's theater critic Bill Marks from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago.
My interest in the book came out of the idea that striptease, especially in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, isn't just pornography, that it's a form of popular entertainment, and so that there was certain music that accompanied it and certain dance steps and a kind of style and skill.
Well, in the book you make the point that blues, the music of Gershwin, I mean standard, you know, Tin Pan Alley tunes were often used as a sort of comic counterpoint to the stripping.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I talk a lot about in the book is that striptease is funny, and that was one of the things that reformers didn't like about it, especially in the 20s and 30s, that the idea was you couldn't both be sexy and funny at the same time.
Now, you suggest in the book that striptease is the only genuine popular art form America has produced. Now, I did have a moment at that line, and I thought of the blues and I thought of jazz. I mean, is this hype or what's going on here?
Obviously, I think blues are a great American art form and jazz dance. But the argument in the book is that, as I said, it's not just pornography. It's something American that's unique that has to do with the myth of rags to riches and so on.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about it in terms of America's the origin of striptease. On the one hand, we're a puritanical country, and yet we've created this art form whose performers had such names as the Wham Wham Girl, Blaze Star, and the Terrific Turkish Torso Twister. So how did America end up inventing striptease?
There are a couple of different threads. One had to do with Salome dancing or Kutch dancing in the 1890s. So forms of American popular dance that were not the waltz kind of shook things up. And then popular music, as you suggest, and I think in general the jazz age just freed things up and also created a kind of competition whereby women had to remove more and more clothing on the stage in order to essentially make money.
Well, that latter point raises another theme in the book, which is that essentially stripping was also part of the sort of class war, would you say, or a class of class?
Yeah, definitely, because in burlesque, certainly, it was mostly performed for the working class, especially at the beginning of its history. But then what happened was that periodically the intelligentsia became very interested in it, and burlesque was always trying to class itself up, you know, somehow to make itself respectable or glamorous or something, with mixed success.
Well, at one point you call it eroticized vaudeville, which I also thought was another interesting definition. Explain that a little bit more. I mean, it wasn't just stripping. It also included comedy, you know, sort of lascivious one-line comics firing off sort of blue humor and a lot of other forms of entertainment.
Yeah, a burlesque show would have in it skits, and there would also be a chorus line and kind of what today would be like a stand-up routine. One of the most famous routines was called the Pickle Persuader, and it had to do with a guy buying a pickle in order to seduce a woman. That was the guy. I know, very sophisticated. But you know, I mean, that gives you an idea of, I mean, it was really about yucks, kind of body humor.
Well, at one point you make the point that it was about titillation and looked at in a comic way, not so much about nudity or, you know, as you mentioned, pornography.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's hard when you start to talk about it today because we have access to so much right away at our fingertips and, you know, just by turning on the television. But, you know, this is a time, you know, especially in the, you know, until the 50s when there wasn't so much access to the kind of entertainment that burlesque and striptease was. So it was a kind of rite of passage for some. To become a stripper was kind of like becoming a showgirl. For many women, it was a way to escape rural poverty and to get into a new economic bracket to change their lives.
Now, in the 60s, striptease started to decline, and you've already mentioned the sexual liberation, but what are the other reasons that stripping just went out of fashion?
One reason was the economics of it. Up until the 50s, there would be generally a live band or some kind of jazz combo or something in a burlesque house. And as burlesque and striptease began to be unable to hold the public interest, theater owners couldn't pay musicians, so they began to just have recorded music or records or what have you. Before, when I was describing how striptease, going to a burlesque theater was a ritual, that was mostly, obviously, men going to burlesque theaters. And when women began to raise consciousness and so on in the 60s, that no longer was acceptable. There were several famous events in the history of feminism where strippers were... The language that you would use in a strip club or a burlesque theater was used to heckle some feminist figures. So it became very charged in the 60s. And certainly the rise of feminism helped kill striptease. But I would say, you know, as much as that, it was the general climate, the zeitgeist of the 60s. One thing I want to say is I'm certainly not trying to romanticize striptease in the book, despite believing that it is this form of American popular entertainment. And from the beginning, gangsters were involved, you know, from the beginning of striptease. However, in the 50s and 60s, as I recount in the book, what happened was with the Kefauver Commission and several of the other crime investigations of the 50s and 60s, those investigations, by targeting gangland, also did away with striptease, you know, because by bringing striptease into the public consciousness as being part of a gangster activity, they demonized it in a different way than it had been.
Now, should we be sad? I mean, is this a you know, an elegy to the end of a popular American art form?
Well, the book is definitely an elegy, yeah. I mean, as you probably know, right now there's a kind of movement to resuscitate this kind of striptease, and women all over the country are performing it and investigating these routines and imitating them and so on. And everywhere I go to talk now, women come up to me and say, you know, I want to start burlesque theater in my town in Vermont, you know, help me or something like that. And so I think it's certainly younger women are interested in something that seems to be a popular entertainment form but is not pornography. So in that sense, I guess I would say, yeah, there should be an elegy for it.
You can pull all the stops out till they call the cops out. Grind your behind till you're banned. But you gotta get a gimmick if you want to get a hand.
Here and now, theater critic Bill Marks speaking with Rachel Stier, author of the new book, Striptease, The Untold History of the Girly Show. It's published by Oxford University Press.
You can up.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Stefano Consonas, and Kevin Sullivan. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. You shake it, Vince. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer, Lindsay Crudell. Our interns, Jen Miller and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.